BBC
Radio 6
Music.
BBC Radio 6 Music documentaries, telling the stories in music that matter.
It's a station for people that love music.
Updated daily on BBC Sounds. Now, 6 Music documentaries present.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series on 6 Music where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Sonic Youth are without doubt one of the most important alternative bands to have emerged from the American post-punk landscape. In 1981, when they formed, the music world was divided into Duran Duran-type pop bands or upcoming guitar bands like The Cure, REM or Echo and the Bunnymen. Sonic Youth forged a third way, as much informed by the avant-garde as by any rock music that had gone before. And since their inception, bassist, guitarist and singer Kim Gordon has been a key element in driving the band forward artistically. She trained as a visual artist, and her desire to experiment with sound helped the band establish themselves as a key influence on indie music. Bands like Nirvana, My Bloody Valentine, PJ Harvey, Dinosaur Jr. and The Flaming Lips all owe a huge debt to Sonic Youth. Also, her position as an articulate woman performer in the mostly male underground inspired countless other female performers. She's also a film and video director, a writer, a fashion designer and a producer. More to the point, she's just cool. In today's show, she talks about her unlikely early musical passions, the dissonant early days of Sonic Youth, her love of Joni Mitchell, Chet Baker, Stan Getz, and her fascination with Karen Carpenter. She also talks about Yoko Ono, who she collaborated with, and the dangers of being in the studio with Courtney Love. But I started by asking her, as I do with all my guests, when was she first aware of music?
Well, I mean, I guess I, you know, heard music in musicals. Movies, you know, like South Pacific or things like that. And then, you know, The Parent Trap with Hayley Mills. I think I had that 7-inch, Let's Get Together.
Nice, nice.
Let's get together, yeah, yeah, yeah. Why don't you and I combine? Let's get together, what do you say? We could have.
Were you attracted to the songs and glamour of musicals then?
I don't know what I was attracted to in those musicals.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was like kind of acting out the song, you know, like in like South Pacific, you know, I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. Sort of like things like that. And then my dad had... you know, he had a lot of jazz records, and I used to listen to, you know, everything from, well, I listened to a lot of Billie Holiday. He had Bessie Smith, and then he had some, like, Chet Baker and Stan Getz, and I remember, like, The Girl from Ipanema, that song. I used to sort of act that out. Like, I used to dance around the house, basically, kind of acting out what scenes from what I thought the songs were.
Kind of acting out the narrative.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then I would set up all the record covers. That's what I would do. I would make an order of the record covers, which would create some kind of narrative, and then I would act that out, and then I would switch it around.
Each one she passes goes, ah.
Even early on, there was a link between music and performance and visuals, you know, and a sort of cinematic atmosphere.
Yeah, I was really intrigued by different record covers. And even if I hadn't heard the music, like there was this one, I think it was a Chet Baker cover where this woman had basically she seemed like she was topless and she had these two puppets cut up with her arms crossed. And it was like lamb chop or something. It was very strange. And I was wondered why that, what that cover was, what, why it was like that.
So what about the first record that you went out and bought for yourself?
Well, that might have been Let's Get Together. That might have been that 7-inch, you know, when I was pretty young. But then it was like maybe Roy Orbison. And then it was like the first Beatles singles. Like you'd walk up to the record store in anticipation of what the new Beatles single or something.
Was there this idea of, I'm listening to this and maybe I can create it too?
No, I didn't ever think that was accessible.
Why not?
Well, I didn't play music for one thing.
I thought that would help.
And, you know, it just seemed, I guess, sort of glamorous and, yeah. I don't know.
Who was the first performer or the first band that you saw live? Can you remember? It's always a big deal.
I think I went to see Herman's Hermits in Hong Kong when I lived there. I mean, it was kind of just surreal that they were there. It actually made it seem accessible. And then my older brother had a friend who had a band who opened for Herman's Hermits. And I don't even know what they sounded like. I don't even remember. I was kind of just interested that that was possible. Like maybe that wasn't possible in the States or something.
But it made an impression on you.
Yeah.
She's a must to avoid, a complete impossibility. She's a must to avoid, better take it from me.
There is that point in someone's life when you stop listening to your parents' music and start finding stuff that speaks directly to you. Can you remember that first happening to you? The kind of first musical obsessions that you felt like the music was existing just for your ears and nobody else's?
Well, I mean, I had an older brother who had, you know, he turned me on to a lot of music, you know, like Dylan and Buffalo Springfield and... Oh, and then I listened to Joni Mitchell, I guess.
When did you first fall in love with her?
I used to make art in my, you know, at home and just listen to her music. And it's so strange because my daughter did that too, but and her friend, as like one of her friends who's a singer in high school, she was really into Joni Mitchell. I found that was so strange. I don't know.
What Joni track should we play?
Well, I guess, you know, Blue is, you know, that's sort of a classic. A Song for a Seagull, though, I was really intrigued because I read somewhere that Jimmy Page said that her guitar playing made him weep, that he would walk around the house listening to it, crying.
Fly, silly seabird, no dreams can possess you. No voices can blame you for sun on your wings. My gentle relations have names they must call me for loving the freedom of all flying things. My dreams with the seagulls fly out of reach, out of eye. I came to the city and lived like old Crusoe on an island of noise in a cobblestone sea, and the beaches concrete, and the stars paid a light bill, and the blossoms hung false on their store window trees. My dreams with the seagulls fly out of reach, out of cry. City and down to the seaside, the sun on my shoulders and wind in my hair. But sandcastles crumble and hunger is human, and humans are seagulls fly out of reach, out of cry. I call to the seagull who dives to the waters and catches a silver fine dinner alone. Crying, where are the footprints that danced on these beaches, and the hands that cast wishes that sunk like a stone? My dreams with the seagulls fly out of reach, out of cry.
So what about when you first started to play an instrument, a guitar? Who did you want to be?
Well, actually, the first band I was in was in when I was in art school in Toronto. Me and this other girl, this Canadian girl, sang, and my friend from high school, who was a percussionist, who also went to school there with me, he played drums, and these two Chilean guys played guitar and bass, and they kind of thought more they were in the Rolling Stones or something. We're more garagey, but they used to be in this band, which I didn't realize at the time, but this infamous band from Chile. It was called the Blops. They were like a famous prog band there. Anyway, we formed out of an art class. So we played at the Ann Arbor Film Festival once, and we were kind of a garage noise band.
What sort of things did you play? Covers?
We did a cover of Honky Tonk Woman. And then I wrote a long song called The Queen of England Blues. And the rest of it is unknown. It was just like... By then they pulled a plug or something. You know, I don't know what else we played. When I moved to New York, my friend Dan Gran, this artist, asked me if I would form an all-girl group with this other girl, Miranda, and Christine Hahn to do this art performance of his, which involves a mirror and the audience, and we're supposed to play and interact with the audience somehow, like an intervention or something. So we formed this band. I played guitar, and a lot of the lyrics were from ad copy, from ads in women's magazines.
Okay.
Things like that.
In terms of Sonic Youth, what were those first Sonic Youth gigs like? Because in the mind of music fans, they're kind of these legendary events, you know, these seminal moments. What were they actually like in reality?
Well, I met Thurston through this girl, Miranda, and at first we were playing with this other girl, this keyboard player, and we kept having different names. Thurston came up with the name Sonic Youth, and we had sort of a better idea of how we wanted the music to be, and Anne left, Anne DeMarinis, and we asked Lee to play with us. And we already had a couple shows for benefits, because that was a way you could actually just play. You didn't really get paid anything, but it was a gig or something, you know, it was someplace to play. And
so you just find a charity gig and turn up, basically.
Well, no, I don't know, somehow, like downtown, you know, there are all these alternative spaces and stuff. So we actually had a couple gigs, and we didn't have a rehearsal space, and we kind of sat around with Lee. We didn't actually, the first couple gigs weren't even with a drummer, I think. And we sort of almost acoustically sat around and talked about what we would do. I think it was probably pretty droney and minimal and rhythmic. And we only had to play for like 15 minutes or something. So the first couple gigs probably aren't memorable, and I'm not really sure I know anyone who saw them.
So can you remember when it first felt like, when it first felt that Sonic Youth had found their audience? You know, always an underground band, but there is that point when people start getting it, understanding what you're doing.
Well, I think the first record that people really paid attention to, like in the press or anything, was Bad Moon Rising. I mean, the first record, we just kind of were lucky. You know, we went into the studio and we had 2 days, one day to record it and one day to mix it. And
is that... That's really fast.
And it was this place, Plaza Sound, where Blondie had recorded. And then the first person to actually kind of write about our music was Grail Marcus, wrote something in Art Form about, I think it was from Bad Mood Rising, I don't know.
But that was something quite positive, something that spurred you on.
It was about the Iggy Pop cover of I Want to Be Your Dog that we kind of took and kind of edited onto a song. I think maybe it was on Confusion, actually. Anyway, that was kind of a big deal that he wrote about it, and that he wrote specifically about me. That was... And we've been friends ever since. We've been, you know, friends ever since that.
That's I Wanna Be Your Dog by The Stooges, a huge influence on my guest here on The First Time, Sonic Youth's Kim Gordon, and a song that the band covered, actually, on their very first album, Confusion is Sex, in 1983.
This is Six Music.
Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music.
Welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, on Six Music. This is the show where we look at the key first musical experiences that mark an artist's lives and their careers. And that was Teenage Riot from Sonic Youth's 1988 album Daydream Nation, the first record of theirs to really make a major impression on the mainstream. And my guest here on The First Time is Sonic Youth bassist and guitarist Kim Gordon. That song was also their first single to chart, so it was technically their first hit. Sort of. Here's Kim.
Well, maybe it's the closest we would ever come to a hit, I guess. Yeah, I mean, that record, I think maybe it was just the timing of it, or, you know, I don't know. People got used to us by 1987.
It was a war of attrition, basically.
Yeah. We wore them down.
I want to ask you about the Carpenters, as you've often mentioned their music as one of your great passions. Karen Carpenter and the voice and songwriting of Karen Carpenter especially.
Well, I guess, you know, started listening to them in the late 80s or something. And we used to play a song in between songs on cassette because we had to sort of change guitars all the time. I remember when we were... It was during the Daydream Nation tour when we went to Russia for the first time, and we were playing We've Only Just Begun, and it was in Kiev, and suddenly, it was the first time the audience, they knew what to do or something, but they put their arms in the air, and they were kind of swaying back and forth. I don't think they'd ever heard the Carpenters, so they had no idea. And it was, you know, before the wall came down and everything, so it was kind of ironic in a way. But I was struck by her voice, how the conservative context wasn't really there, so you could just listen to the music. And she did have this such a soulful and sexy voice, I think.
And a great drummer.
Yeah, and a great drummer as well.
We've only just begun to live, white lace and promises. A kiss for luck and we're on our way.
We've only begun
before the rising sun. We fly so many roads to choose. We start
Your sixth album, 1990's Goo, was another breakthrough because that was the first record that you did on a major label, on a corporate record company, on Geffen, which was a huge deal at the time. One of the most underground bands in America, kind of go corporate, and you were followed onto a major label by other bands from the underground like Nirvana. I mean, did it seem like a big deal at the time?
Well, I mean, we'd been together for 10 years, and The Replacements and Husker Du, did they sign to a major? I mean, that was kind of a big deal. And so we didn't feel like we were the first. And even if it sort of fell apart, we felt like, well, we've been together for 10 years, so, you know, whatever. But it was, I guess we were kind of curious what our songs would sound like with the bigger budget production behind them. And
in hindsight, do you think it was a successful thing to do?
Well, I think that it definitely gave us a higher profile than maybe we would have had if we stayed on an indie label. But it's very hard to tell. I mean, being back on Matador for the last record was... It felt kind of like a nice hug or something. It was like,
but Goo did become this very big record, and you definitely weren't a band with their kind of eye set on the mainstream, you know, on mainstream success or indeed mainstream music.
Well, I don't know if we ever really felt like we were brought into the mainstream. I think we are maybe on the edge of the mainstream, or, you know, when we toured opening for Neil Young during that time of that first record on Geffen, you know, his audience certainly didn't think we were mainstream, or we and his crew really kind of looked at us like we were sort of freaks, or they kept waiting for us to act out like they thought we were punks, and it actually kind of made us feel young. Whereas we always felt like we were always the older ones in the hardcore scene, or we weren't in the hardcore scene. We were, you know. So it was, that was kind of interesting, like, you know, to see, well, actually, no, the mainstream is not, or at least his fans weren't, you know. And that we could still actually play music and shock people was kind of interesting.
Here we go to another candlelight night.
Can you tell me about first meeting Yoko Ono? That's someone that you've collaborated with in the past and a bit of a hero of yours, a hero of mine, hero of everybody's.
I met her a number of years ago. I don't know, I think I met her at her birthday party. Sean invited me. He's friends with Mike D and the Beastie Boys, and they were there, and they were friends of ours. And I think a lot of Sean's friends, she became her friends, or, you know, that was a social part of her social world in a certain way. And then I interviewed her for something, and I did a lecture on her for at the Walker Arts Center when she had her, when a retrospective was traveling. Well, she's so unconventional. I think what I read about her is that she was always kind of an outsider, even in Japan, because her parents traveled to the West. And that she came from early on, you know, she was so involved with the avant-garde in New York, and that she also had some love of, like, pop. And I think it was really hard for her to, you know, not only was she coming into a situation where she was interfacing with one of the most beloved pop stars of in the world, but that she also was coming from one of the most obscure sort of forms of art practice, you know, Fluxism. And so I think people had no idea what her context was at all. You know, they just kind of heard about her weird art show in London where they met or something like that. And I don't know, I just think that she's really had to, I don't know, the mantle of the someone's legacy also is, it's really challenging to deal with. And I think it's really, I think she probably grappled for a long time with actually losing her own identity in her relationship.
Which is kind of great now because she's so loved as an artist and someone in her own right.
Yeah.
We kind of moved away from just that she was John Lennon's widow idea, which is brilliant. What should we play of hers?
Mulberries? Mulberries. It's the one where John plays sort of feedback guitar and she says Mulberries.
Tell me about producing Courtney Love, which is because you produced the very first whole album, Pretty on the Inside, in 1991. How was that?
You know, we only had a week, and, you know, there are a lot of emotional moments.
What do you mean by emotional?
There's some throwing of things that, I don't know. She had interesting techniques to get her band motivated.
Go on.
I mean, I don't know, it's just... you know, she was very charming to us. Yeah, that's all I can really say. The first time I saw her play, you know, she was clearly someone who had a lot of charisma, and but was also like someone who I normally would like run away from immediately.
Can you remember the first reaction that you got when the news broke that Sonic Youth were going to split up? Like, after 30 years together, you know, for fans, it was a pretty big deal. A lot of people took it pretty hard.
Yeah, I guess I really was shocked at how people... I mean, I guess I knew people would be sad about it. But, I don't know, I really tried not to really read stuff on the internet about it. I mean, I'm really grateful, and when I think back on how we started or how it all worked together. I mean, you just really never know what's going to work and what isn't, or you know, I can't imagine being, if we'd started now, what would happen. Or it's really puzzling to me. It's, you know, it's just music.
So now you've got this new album coming out. It's a collaboration with Bill Nace, an album project called Body Head. It's very improvisational, very experimental.
I guess so. I mean, I just wanted to do something purely that I wanted to do. And it's not like anyone's going to make money in the music world, or certainly not. So that's like a road that I'm not interested in. So many uncreative aspects to that sort of a lifestyle that I'm so not interested in. And that's just not who I am. So, you know, I just thought, you know, I've known Bill for a long time and we'd played together before with other people. And I just wanted to do something that just was purely fun and felt good. And that's kind of the way Sonic Youth started in a way.
And after all that, we have to ask you to pick the last song that we're going to play. It can be anything you want.
Oh, man. Well, I'm not sure of the song or the record, but do you have something by Catherine Ribeiro and the Alps?
Why that piece of music?
I just think she's a really great singer. She's pretty inspirational to me. It's kind of proggy, but it's not exactly... Like, she really drives it, and... I don't know, it's just really, really intense, but also really musical.
Then that's what we'll play. Thank you very much for speaking to us.
Nice speaking with you. Oh, 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 oh.
Music. Why don't you be good for something and draw down the shade on a sign that's up all night shivering.
Music. This morning from 11, Huey Morgan.
At 8, Radcliffe and Marconi.
Right now.
It's Chris Hawkins.